Okay, thank you, Roger. I want to begin by saying that it is an inspiration to be here. I think this kind of group, 46 events is it now? It's just extremely impressive. And whenever people ask me what's going on with radical history these days, I say the most interesting stuff is going on in Bristol, England. And so it's terrific that you have Rich, who's doing this outstanding website. So maybe a new kind of movement, which was originally the idea of the History Workshop Journal, the idea being to democratize the practice of history and bring it closer to people's lives. I think that's what this is about, fundamentally. So it's a tremendous honor to be here. I got an email yesterday from Peter Linebaugh, who says all of his greetings. He's very sorry that he can't be here. He said that last year was just such a tremendous experience. So his hat and my hat, they are off to you. Thank you very much for what you're doing. Now, as for my talk about pirates, I find that Nicholas has said everything. So it really was an excellent talk, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, he's left me nothing to say. So I'm just going to fumble with some papers and do the best I can and tell you a pirate story. Okay? We love pirate stories, don't we? Arr, you got it. Okay. You notice my title, The Real Pirates of the Caribbean. That is a none too subtle allusion to the movies. Pirates of the Caribbean 1, 2, and 3. I assume they've been here. Okay, here, let's start the story this way. A group of men stands on the scaffold, bound in chains, awaiting execution. Others have already been hanged. The dead are now being removed to make room for the soon to die. They are all pirates. Some are wearing brilliant white frocks, others still wearing tattered seaman's garb. Their captured flag, the Jolly Roger, billows up above the gallows so that everyone, and especially sailors, in this port city will know the reason for the hanging. Several hundred people turn up to witness the spectacle. There are different classes of people in the crowd. A group of gentlemen, colonial officials, merchants, a naval officer or two stand out in their finery, wigs, and ruffles. One of these men is a merchant who has helped to bring these pirates to these very gallows. He and the other rich men are surrounded by their servants, their slaves, and a sizable armed guard. With them are several rougher but still respectable ship captains, a couple of them in cheap, ill-fitting wigs. The gentlemen know that the condemned have friends in the crowd, and maybe some friends among the soldiers who are arrayed to guard them. Tensions run high. Milling around with them are the working poor from whose ranks the pirates come. These include a man named Walter Kennedy and his African-American friend, John Gwynn. Here they come now. These two are between voyages and decide to turn up to watch the execution. The whole crowd listens quietly as the death sentences are read. The magistrate gravely explains that the pirates are the villains of all nations and the common enemies of mankind. Some of these pirates on the gallows begin to pray, but most of them remain defiant. one uses his last wish to request a cup of wine, and he makes a toast to the villains of all nations, which elicits cheers and screams and support from the crowd. The last pirate to speak confronts the authorities and attempts to turn the event into a rousing last stand. The crowd has grown unruly and surges forward. The soldiers in the front hold the line, cracking heads with the butts of their muskets as the second and third line of soldiers nervously train their weapons on the crowd. Walter, John, and their friends slip away down a side street to avoid the combat that has just begun. They go to a pub like the Seven Stars, and they're in an emotional turmoil because Walter feels they should have stayed and rushed the stand with the other sailors in the crowd to try to save the lives of those pirates, but he didn't do it. Something held him back. Meantime, he and John have met an older man who seems a little bit too friendly. And he starts buying them drinks. And they drink. And they drink. And they drink. This man's name, it turns out, is Sam the Spirit. He leaves them passed out in various spots. And the next thing John and Walter know is that they wake up severely hungover, chained to each other and to a rough beam of wood on a vessel that is moving. Slowly, through fogged senses, they begin to get a sense of where they are, and what they see are lots of manacles and chains. They're on an outward bound slave ship. They've been spirited. Turns out that they're released from their irons, they take their place among the crew, and they begin to work. The rest of the crew is a bunch of tough sea wolves, much like themselves, young people like Walter and John. Mostly English, but there's a Frenchman, there's a Greek, several dark-skinned people of unknown nationality. It's a motley crew, as it always is. Despite their differences, they begin to work together. A certain camaraderie develops, a certain spirit, all over and against the captain, a man named Skinner. Maybe there's some symbolism in that. Captain Skinner, who is the most brutal tyrant anyone had yet known. It was because of people like Skinner that Walter and John had always stayed away from the slave trade. But now, through no fault of their own, they're here on the ship. Well, Captain Skinner is a hard-driving man, and he doesn't treat the crew quite the right way. In fact, not long into the voyage, he cuts back on their customary allotment of rum. Walter thinks this is wrong, and he's going to put it right. So he breaks into the captain's cabin and steals a keg of his brandy. All on the slave ship, just like this one. And do you know how you can tell it's a slave ship? Some of you probably do know. Here at the waterline, there are several airports to ventilate the lower deck for the slaves who will be picked up. The stench of it is a big part of the story. Anyway, Walter and John and their messmates, it's a kind of a work group, a group that eats together, works together, spends a lot of time together, are upset about this loss of the rum. Walter steals the captain's brandy and he gets caught. And he gets flogged for it. Now, this is a difficult thing for Walter to take because he's extremely proud of bearing. And he's never been flogged before. After the scene, after the flogging, he's helped back down below by his mates. And they then begin to talk to him about what's just happened. They talk with anger, with sympathy, with humor. One of his mates, a man known as Nanny, that's an ironic nickname because he's got the most vicious temper of anybody on board the ship. Nanny volunteers to kill the captain this minute. I will go kill the son of a bitch right now. I'm ready to kill him. But there are cooler heads, and they say, no, no. There's another guy named Mulatto Jack who kind of pushes Nanny aside and then begins to joke. And he says, well, Walter, you're finally a tiger. And everybody laughs. What it meant was that Walter had now been initiated into the fraternity of the deep sea sailor. He was a tiger because now he has stripes on his back. And this in turn prompts a telling of stories. All of the sailors take turns taking off their shirts and showing the scars on their backs and explaining the stories of how they got their tiger stripes. A man named Old Dad says he got his after the mutiny on the Antelope in 1699. A big sailor known as Timberhead brags about the time he punched out Captain Wilson on the Mary Ann in 1715. Finally, John Gwynn, the black sailor, pulls off his shirt and reveals beneath it a kind of scar tissue that no one has ever seen before. He says, HMS Carolina. And even though nobody has ever heard of a ship called Carolina, they know what he meant. John Gwynn was a runaway slave who had been lashed this way on a Carolina plantation. Well, this is a knot of seamen. This is a group who will stay together for the rest of the story. It's a story that's going to lead eventually to a mutiny, to piracy, to revenge against ship captains like Skinner and merchants like the man who brought those others to be hanged. And I read it in deliberate contrast to the Pirates of the Caribbean because it's a film treatment that I've written. Ah, there's the punchline. I'm actually working to make the first realistic pirate movie. Okay? But I thought it might be useful to contrast the Hollywood fantasy with the actual history. Talk about that a little bit. Let's start with the Hollywood fantasy. How many people here have seen Pirates of the Caribbean, one or another of them? Okay, so you know that there are basically two kinds of pirates. Most of the pirates are stupid, greedy, violent, depraved, and people with bad teeth and bad hair, right? This is the way Hollywood depicts most pirates, but to tell you the truth, that's the way they depict most working class people. They have a very hard time depicting working class people in movies. Right? That's just sort of a fairly standard way to do it. Some of them are missing limbs, you will have noticed. This, of course, is an old stereotype of pirates. It goes back to Robert Louis Stevenson's Treasure Island. But the point that I like to make about that is that when you think of a pirate with a hook for a hand and a patch on an eye and a peg leg, you know what you should conclude? Not that this is some kind of romantic idol of fiction, but that being a sailor was a very dangerous line of work. And that in fact, a great many sailors had their bodies ruined in just this way. Now, here's what you need to know to understand that. Imagine a cannonball hitting a wooden ship at high velocity. Splinters everywhere. chunks of wood everywhere. That's how you lose an eye. That's how you lose a hand. That's how you lose a leg. The pirates will develop a social security system to protect against those who are injured. To go back to a theme that was raised earlier. Okay, so that's one kind of pirate. Then there's another kind of pirate that makes its way to Hollywood films, and this is the noble, dashing, usually aristocratic character who has suffered some kind of personal misfortune or injustice. Right? This is the Errol Flynn type of pirate, right? Well, I want to tell you folks, there weren't any aristocrats on pirate ships. They had better things to do than go to sea, where life was nasty, poor, brutish, and short. And I would mention that the twist, the only interesting twist, really, of the Pirates of the Caribbean is by creating this kind of witty, swishy, lovable rogue, Jack Sparrow. Like, that was a little bit daring. Not much. And then it became kind of old hat. But this is basically the Hollywood fantasy. It turns out, folks, that the real history of pirates is a lot more interesting than that. The real history is much more interesting, and the way we can get into that is just by asking who the pirates were. Now, I'm going to talk about one specific generation. I'm going to talk about the pirates of the period, roughly about 1716 to 1726. Nicholas has already told you a lot about them. But I want to kind of provide a social profile, tell you something that I've learned about them, and tell you why I think that they matter to us today. Okay, why we would benefit from knowing about what they did. Okay, the pirates of this generation were probably 4,000 or 5,000 in number. Now that may not sound like a lot, but in 1716, the Royal Navy had 10,000, 11,000, 12,000 men. It was enough to cause a tremendous crisis in the Atlantic trading system, as Nicholas has pointed out. Pirates captured thousands of vessels and did tremendous amounts of property damage. Now, who were they? Well, what's especially interesting about this generation of pirates is this is really the first time when poor working sailors get control of piracy. In earlier times, there were usually merchants funding them. Even William Kidd had some backers who were members of Parliament. But by the time you get to this period, the upper classes have basically said no, for reasons Nicholas described. Commerce is now too valuable, and they don't want any disruptions. So it's poor people who basically get control of piracy in this period. Poor working sailors. Where had they worked? They had worked in all of the maritime industries of the day. They had worked in the Royal Navy. They had worked in the merchant shipping industry. Some of them had been privateers. They were all of them seafaring people. Experience. In fact, it was often said that the best of the sailors will be pirates. So it was kind of a fraternity of skill among them. Now, another thing that's crucial to note is that they were themselves, like all of the other ships of the Atlantic, multi-ethnic in the extreme. And one of the things that impressed me most of all was the number of pirates who were of African descent. I'd say overall, probably 30% of the pirates in this period were either African or African-American. And on some ships, it was 50 or 60 or even 70%. What's especially interesting is that a number of the sailors who had joined up with the pirates joined from slave ships, where the working conditions were especially awful. Even after coming from a slave ship, those pirates were apparently happy to welcome sailors of African descent on board. You know why? It's a little bit interesting. To be a good pirate didn't depend on the color of your skin. To be a good pirate depended upon how committed you could be to the group as a whole. A runaway slave, folks, could be very committed to being a pirate. because the back would look like John Gwynn's, and if they went back to the plantation, they would probably be killed. So there's a way in which piracy levels the occupational ranks. Everybody has an opportunity if they are willing to give it all to the cause. I want to mention there were also women pirates. I'm sure everybody here knows about Anne Bonny and Mary Read. They were two young women who dressed as men and went to sea. I'll just tell one brief story about each one of them. They were both physically tough, skilled, like most working class women of the day. Mary Read had been a soldier, actually, on the continent, had fought in the War of Spanish Succession. She was on a transport ship that was taken by pirates, and she joined up. Well, just to give you an idea of what she was like, she actually fell in love with a fellow pirate. And that fellow pirate, a young man, got into a scrap one day with another, much more rugged pirate who challenged him to a duel. Mary Read was absolutely convinced that that rugged pirate was going to kill her sweetheart when they went ashore to fight a duel at sword and pistol. So what did Mary Read do? She gave it some thought. Then she got into a scrap with that same rugged pirate, challenged him to a duel an hour before the one that was to take place with her sweetheart, went ashore and killed him on the spot. Problem solved. Okay? She knew her way around guns. She had been using one for years. There's another story about Anne Bonny that in her youth, a young man who had a great and romantic interest in her got a little fresh and a little forward and actually tried to rape her. And what was said about that is that she gave him such a beating that he was unable to move around for a very long time. So Anne Bonny and Mary Read are very tough and swashbuckling pirates in every way, and quite famous in their own day, incidentally. I also mentioned that there were gay pirates. A pirate ship as a relatively free space meant that there was sexual freedom as well as other kinds of freedom. Now, we don't have a lot of evidence about this, but I came across one instance in which a group of people who were captured from a pirate ship came ashore and gave testimony against pirates, and one of the men who gave testimony pointed to one of the pirates and said, "That man told me, I wish you and I were ashore on a deserted island, stark naked. Good enough for me." So there's a powerful class experience among these pirates. I think this is one of the things that makes them who they are. They've worked on board these ships. They've been beaten, many of them, like Walter Kennedy. They've been given very poor quality food. They've been given low wages and in many cases bilked of their wages completely. They've suffered at the hands of tyrannical ship captains and merchants. And now that they are on board a pirate ship, they're going to change everything. Here's, I think, maybe the key. Nichols talked about how people tried to live differently. Pirates are a classic instance of it. The thing they most wanted to change was the concentrated power of the ship captain. You've got to remember, the 18th century, I'm sure most of you know, was a period in which ship captains had almost unchecked power to do whatever they wanted. Powers of corporal punishment. These are instruments of torture that were very commonly used on slave ships, but they were also commonly used against sailors, even on slave ships. Everybody recognizes the cat of nine tails, right? With the knots in the end to increase the power of this instrument to lacerate human flesh. Some captains would even thread wire through the cord to make it cut more effectively. This is the kind of violence that they were up against, with very little recourse, I might add, other than recourse that they themselves could bring to bear through mutiny or desertion. But once these sailors, these common sailors of poor background, got control of a ship of their own, pirate ship, it's fascinating to see how they do things differently. And believe me, folks, they do things differently. They do not run the ship in the same way as the Navy, the same way as the merchants, even the same way as the privateers. They do things very, very differently. Let me give you a few examples. The first thing they do is to limit the power of the captain. And there are several ways they do that. First, they elect their captain. Capital is not chosen by a merchant, some rich man who wants his capital to be protected. The captain is chosen by the crew collectively, who meet in a council and vote. Now, I'm sure I'd have to remind you, this is the early 18th century. This is not a time when working people can vote. This is not a democratic society. And yet these pirates are voting and voting and voting. In fact, one captain who was taken on board as a captive, he said, it's just pure anarchy. They vote about everything. What are we going to do next? Well, let's vote about it. Let's have a big debate. And of course, the debates were improved by the quality and quantity of rum consumed. Limit the power of the captain by voting. Now, you'll pick a captain who is knowledgeable. But you're also going to pick a captain who's bold, and most of all, a captain who's not going to, in any way, misuse his authority. Moreover, they put another limitation on his power, which is the captain of a pirate ship has unchecked authority only when they are in battle or chasing a prize ship. All the other time, he will consult with the crew and the other ship's officers, who are also elected. An especially interesting thing was, I think this is something trade unions ought to try. They elected somebody called a quartermaster. And the quartermaster had a very interesting job. They say, your job as quartermaster is to keep an eye on him, the captain, and make sure he doesn't do anything that will violate our interests as a crew. We are all powerful here. We want you to keep an eye on him. And moreover, he's not going to control all the booty. You are. So the quartermaster was always someone who was the most trusted person on board the vessel. Somebody you're going to let hold all your money for you and then dole it out fairly. Okay? Another constraint on the captain's authority. This is very important. Kind of a dual executive. Okay? So there's this democracy that's operating on board the ship. They also limit the power of the captain to wield the cat. How do they do that? They basically say, okay, when someone commits an infraction, and they did have infractions, for example, if you were to desert your battle station in a time of engagement, your fellow pirates might decide that you need to be disciplined for that because you're putting everybody at risk, right? But they're not going to let the captain do it. They're not going to let the quartermaster do it. What are they going to do? We're going to get everybody together and we're going to debate whether the person should be punished and if so, what the punishment should be. It says in these articles, and pirates did create articles, kind of it's almost like the constitution of their ship. Punishments will be given out according to what the crew as a whole thinks is appropriate. Now, I can't tell you how different this is from the seafaring life that these people knew. You know why? Because the ship captain's power was tyrannical and arbitrary in the extreme. The captain could whip whomever he wanted, as hard as he wanted, even to death, and then justify it very easily. And pirates said, no, we're not going to do that. That's not going to happen on these ships. Now, their punishments could be severe in some cases, but it was nothing like what happened on board the other ships because the control was collected. That's what's important about it. Another thing they did, again, discussed briefly by Nicholas, they divided up their loot in extremely equal ways. Now, here's how you would understand this. A captain of the Royal Navy would make somewhere between 50 to 60 to 100 times as much money as the lowest common sailor. Depends on the size of the vessel. A merchant captain will make from 6 to 10 to 20 to 30 times as much, depending on how much cargo of his own he has on and if he's perhaps a part owner. The captain on a pirate ship got 1.5 or 2 shares, and the lowest sailor on board got 1. So there is a radical compression of the wage or pay hierarchy on board the ship. And pirates were smart about this because this helped them in recruiting. Right? You want to join up with us? Our captains don't really get anything. We get it as a crew. And sailors liked that idea. That agreed with them. Culturally, they had egalitarian values because they felt that everybody survived in this situation. So the division of resources is very equal. And there's another very important thing that pirates do. They actually abolish the wage and use what Nicholas called the share system. They didn't consider themselves to be wage laborers at all. They were common owners of the ship. Not because they bought it, but because they just captured it and made it their own. So they're kind of, yeah, they're sort of joint owners, like the ship is a commons. It belongs to everybody. That's a different way of thinking about the ship. You abolish wage labor. Another very important practice, which speaks, I think, to the experience of the sailors who became pirates, this took place whenever a prize ship was captured. Now, the Hollywood image, you would imagine all these kind of stupid, greedy people with bad teeth running down below and just plundering the ship, right? That's not usually what they did. When a ship was captured, usually there would be a boarding party of pirates led by the quartermaster who would come aboard after the ship surrenders. And by the way, they all surrender. All this hand-to-hand combat, folks, it didn't happen. You know why? Because nobody wanted to fight the pirates. I'll give you an example in a source that I found. A captain actually later testified in court that there was a vessel on the horizon. This is a merchant captain. There's a vessel on the horizon, and its crew, they're not sure what it is. You can't tell. So the crew as a group comes to the captain, and they say, Captain, it's a mostly English crew. They say, Captain, if it's a Spanish vessel, we'll fight with you to the last drop of our blood. If it's a pirate ship, you're on your own. We're not going to fight them. You know why? Because if you fight back and lose, which you are almost certainly going to do, because the typical merchant ship will have 15 to 20 hands, and the typical pirate ship will have 75 to 80, you're going to lose. And if they come on board your vessel and you've managed to kill one or two of their fraternity, they're not going to be in a good mood about it. So they will torture you if you resist. Then they'll say to the common sailors, we are on your side. Why are you risking your life for this captain and that merchant? What's wrong with you that you would do this? Well, when they did come on board, they enacted something called the distribution of justice. The distribution of justice. I think it's a fascinating phrase, the distribution of justice. And this involved not plundering, but calling the crew and the officers of the prize vessel up onto the main deck. And they line up the crew over here, and they line up the captain over there. And the quartermaster of the pirate vessel, in a moment of high drama, says to the gathered crew of the prize ship, he says, "How does your captain treat you?" Well, it's a kind of a moment of truth, isn't it? If the sailors say, "Our captain..." "Our captain is a brutal man who lashes us for no reason, who gives us poor provisions, who doesn't pay us our wages properly. I want to tell you, that captain is in trouble." Pirates would then act as avengers of the common sailor. And what they would do in that instance is tie that captain up in the same place that he would tie up his sailors and give him a beating that he would never forget, saying, "Here's what you get for mistreating your sailors. People did that to us, and we are now going to take it out on you." I found one really interesting occasion where a group of pirates captured a prize vessel, and two of the pirates had been on that captain's vessel and been mistreated by him. And one person who's on board said, "Ah, Captain so-and-so, is it really you? I've been waiting to see you after all these years." They killed him. They murdered him. Now, some pirates carried this kind of vengeance to an extremely bloody extremity. There was one pirate named Philip Lyne who was hanged in 1726 who bragged on the gallows that he had killed 37 masters of ships. It's a kind of pathology, but it's a pathology born of the violence and torment and terror that he himself had suffered. One crew of pirates, with a man named Bartholomew Roberts, some of you may know him, he was a Welshman who became the most famous pirate of the Golden Age. He and his crew captured about 400 vessels. He's the kind of guy that when the Royal Navy patrols and men of war were sent after him, they would see him and then change course and go in a different direction, because he had a big ship too. They had a man on that ship whose job, if you look down the list of the kind of the formal division of labor, you know, you've got first mate, second mate, surgeon, boatswain, this distributor of justice. There's a guy on the crew who's just known as the distributor of justice, and I've got a feeling he was a pretty big guy. Just have a feeling. So pirates are trying to escape a certain world that they knew as sailors. And I think this even extends to the pirate flag. One of the things I've talked about in my book, Villains of All Nations, is that there really are two quite distinct but related meanings of the Jolly Roger, the skull and crossbones. One meaning is obvious, and that is that whenever the skull and crossbones, or more commonly an entire skeleton, sometimes holding a weapon, sometimes the weapon piercing a heart, sometimes holding an hourglass. Very interesting. When that flag goes up, the message to the prize vessel is very clear. Surrender or die. They all surrendered, almost all of them. A few tried to fight. A few got away. Not many. But what I've suggested is that if you look at this from the point of view of the experience of the common sailor, it has a different set of meanings. The skull and crossbones is the symbol of death. It's actually very common in the gravestone art of the 18th century. Where did pirates get that symbol? They got it from the drawing that a ship captain would make in his log to indicate the death of a sailor. On this day died my cooper, John Stewart, skull and crossbones, in the captain's log. So what I think that skull and crossbones represented was a system of death in which sailors felt trapped. The other symbols of the flag make the same point. A weapon, drops of blood, an hourglass, violence, death, limited time. Most sailors didn't live very long. It was an occupation in which mortality was very high. But they felt that by breaking out of that and becoming pirates, they had a new chance to live. In fact, there's one pirate who was confronted by a ship captain who says, "Don't you know you're going to be hanged for this?" He said, "Yeah, I know. Let us live while we can." And herein lay one of the most important mottos, and I think one of the most revealing mottos of the sailor's, of the pirate's life. A merry life and a short one. Let's live, even if we won't live very long. And in fact, they knew they weren't going to live very long. Hundreds of pirates were hanged, as Nicholas said. But for those few years they lived as pirates, they lived very well. They lived in what was practically a utopia for a common sailor, in which they had a democratic way of doing things, a captain who was under control. They had endless food and feasting and drinking. And this wasn't always a good thing. When Bartholomew Roberts' vessel was actually found by a man of war, the crew was too drunk to fight back effectively. They end up being captured and 52 of them hanged in a slave trading fortress on the coast of West Africa. But it was a very good life while it lasted. I think that's the key point. And what I've suggested is that it's certainly true that pirates are doing tremendous damage to mercantile property. But one of the things that brought the wrath of the ruling classes down on their heads was daring to run a ship in a different way. That was really subversive. It's a little bit like Vietnam, Cuba, Nicaragua, daring to rupture a model of imperial dominance. And those countries must be punished for that ever after by the United States. It's not even strictly the economic interest in any of them. It's that they might give other people the idea that you can successfully resist the United States. The same was true of pirates. They gave great hope to other sailors, and that's why they were always the heroes of sailors. And you know what, folks? That's why they're our heroes, too. Because we know, in our heart of hearts, whatever that Hollywood fantasy may be, that these were rebels who were willing to risk their lives to try to do something different. I think we should honor that. Now, the last thing I'd like to do in this presentation is talk a bit about something that I think isn't often mentioned about pirates, and that is they had a tremendous sense of humor. They really had a very good sense of humor. I'll give you one example. One pirate ship was very busy, very active. They took a prize vessel. They found on the vessel several reams of paper with a proclamation by the Lords of Admiralty. That was some pompous thing about the rules of the empire or something. And the pirates started to laugh and carry on. And the captain later relayed this story. The captain says, they started laughing. They said, "They're not the lords of the sea. We are the lords of the sea, and we want all of those papers." And they took them. And the guy said, "Well, why do you want them?" They said, "Well, we're out of toilet paper." They had a sense of humor. They also had a sense of humor which was reflected in a play. This is, I think, one of the greatest documents about pirates that I've ever come across. Now, I want to read some parts of it. It's not very long, but it gives you a sense of what they're like. Now, here's the situation. This is a group of pirates with a man named Thomas Anstis. They've been pirating for several years, and they've petitioned the king for a pardon. They know they're not going to get it, but they're hoping that they might, and so they're living a kind of marooning life on a small island off the coast of Cuba. And while they're doing that, every day they have to find ways to sort of entertain themselves. So they sing and they dance and they perform plays. And they perform plays that they themselves make up. Well, it turns out that one of these plays made its way back to London and was eventually published. The play is one in which the pirates act like they are an English court of law, and they're going to be trying some chosen men for piracy. Now, you've got to realize this. These are people who have had friends convicted in such courts of law and hanged. Okay? So here's what they do. They first of all pick out somebody who's going to be the judge. And he gets an old black tarpaulin and throws it over his shoulder and the end of a mop for his wig. And he climbs up in a tree so that he can look down on the whole proceeding in a very kind of superior way. They nominate someone else to be the attorney general. And they pick one guy to be the poor sailor who's being tried for piracy. Okay? Now you got to remember, this is a group of pirates acting all this out. Okay. The play begins and the courtroom comes to order. The attorney general says, "And please your lordship and you gentlemen of the jury, here before you is a fellow who is a sad dog, a sad, sad dog, and I hope your honor will order him to be hanged immediately. He has committed piracy on the high seas, and we shall prove that this fellow, this sad dog before you, has escaped a thousand storms, nay, has got safe ashore when the ship has been cast away, which is a certain sign that he was not born to be drowned. Yet not having the fear of hanging before his eyes, he goes on and commits very serious piracies. But this is not all, my lord. He has committed worse villainies than all those, for as we shall prove, he has been guilty of drinking small beer. And your lordship knows there never was a sober fellow, but was a rogue. Now, my lord, I would have spoken much finer than I do now, but as your lordship knows, our rum is all out, and how could a man speak good law who has not drunk a dram? However, I hope your lordship will order this fellow to be hanged." Now here's the judge. The judge says, "Harkee me, sir, you lousy, pitiful, ill-looked dog. What have you to say while you should not be tucked up immediately and set a-sun-drying like a scarecrow? Are you guilty or not guilty?" And the sailor answers, not guilty. "And please your worship." "Not guilty, sir, say so again, and I'll have you hanged without any trial." "And please your worship's honor, my lord, I'm as honest a poor fellow as ever went between stem and stern of a ship, and can hand and reef and steer and clap two ends of a rope together as well as ever he that went about and crossed salt water. But I was taken by one George Bradley." George Bradley is playing the part of the judge. You see, "I was taken by one George Bradley, a notorious pirate and a sad rogue as ever went unhanged. And George Bradley forced me to do it, your honor." Judge, George Bradley. Answer me, sir, how will you be tried? Prisoner, by God and my country. The devil you will. Why then, gentlemen of the jury, I think we have nothing to do but to proceed to judgment. Attorney General, right, my lord, for if the fellow should be suffered to speak, he may clear himself, and that's an affront to the court. Prisoner, pray, my lord, I hope your lordship will consider. Consider? How dare you talk of considering, sir? I never considered in all my life. I'll make it treason to consider. But I hope your lordship will hear some reason. Do you hear how the scoundrel prates? What do we have to do with reason? I'll have you know, rascal, we don't sit here to hear reason. We go according to law. Is my dinner ready? Attorney General, yes, my lord. Then, listen, you rascal at the bar. Hear me, hear me. You must suffer for three reasons. First, because it is not fit that I should sit here as judge and nobody be hanged. Second, you must be hanged because you have a damned hanging look. And third, you must be hanged because I am hungry, and that it is a custom that whenever the judge's dinner is ready, before the trial is over, the prisoner is to be hanged, of course. There's law for you, you dog. Take him away, jailer. And then the whole scene erupts into hilarity. And all the pirates start laughing, which, of course, was the point. This is a kind of black humor, because every single one of them faced the gallows and they knew it. In fact, George Bradley was eventually captured and taken to the island of Bermuda, where he underwent a real trial and would be tucked up like a scarecrow and set a sun drying on the gibbet, and I just wonder what was on his mind as that happened. Thank you very much. Somebody, you know, you should perform this play. I think this would be a great thing for the Bristol Radical History Group to do.
That's a good idea. Any questions, then?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor, Chair. Can you talk about Treasure Island and to what extent that has any truth in it, or corresponds to some knowledge? Yeah. Did Stevenson know anything about piracy and so on?
Yeah, good question. In case people couldn't hear it in the back, it's about Stevenson and Treasure Island and how much history is in it. I think Stevenson's novel is probably the main reason why everybody today loves pirates, because pirates then entered children's literature. And pirates then became part of a fantasy life that many people have grown up with. I actually found some of the documents that Stevenson would have read in writing it. For example, I found the guy who was the peg leg and the patch for the eye. So it's clear that he did some research. But I think, in general, the history is not bad. There's some parts of it that are right, some parts of it are clearly fantasy and made up. But it's a tremendously important document, and I would say it is probably the single most influential thing that's ever been written on the history of piracy.
What I've
noticed
was, is there any literary truth in it? I mean, does it correspond to anything real?
Well, here's
the literary way.
Yeah, I hate to be the bearer of bad tidings, but pirates didn't bury their treasure. And they also didn't make people walk the plank. Now, they could find other horrible things besides walking the plank. But it's Stevenson who has, I think, made the buried treasure a central part of the piracy myth. What I found basically is that pirates did not believe in deferred gratification of any kind. And so therefore they didn't want to bury their treasure. Their attitude was, they called their booty our golden luggage, and they would lug it into the nearest port, spend it all, and then go back to sea. Some pirate crews actually had a rule that you could not go back to sea until you had spent all your money. It's interesting to think about why that was so. One, if you take money back to sea, you may not be as hungry and going after prizes. Or two, if you take money back to sea, you'll start gambling and you'll start fighting with each other about it. So I think the biggest myth that probably comes from Treasure Island is buried treasure. I do get calls quite frequently from treasure hunters, and I tell them that I know exactly where the stuff is buried, but I'm just not going to let them know.
Any questions?
Speak out, because there's a fan up here.
Thank you very much for very entertaining the correlation between bikers and the art schools, they have pirates. It's very, very similar.
I agree.
And also, I used to be a printer. And we had articles.
You had what?
Articles.
Yeah.
And we were indentured slaves, believe it or not.
Interesting.
For 3,500 years, so not longer. Wow. So you'd be direct. Well, that's very much why you drink today. I think I owe you one. I owe you a drink.
Thank you.
But the correlation between bikers and pirates to the present day now is still relevant, I think.
Yeah, I think so. I think bikers are a kind of rebellious subculture that would have been quite familiar to the pirates. There's a way in which they have kind of bonded among themselves over and against what other people may think of them. And one of the things, I find that among pirates, there was kind of a punk sensibility too. It's sort of like, whatever you are afraid of, we're that. You know, for years and years, for centuries, people who committed piracy would always pretend they were something else. Right? They were privateers and it was lawful and this and that. This generation of pirates, you know what they said? Yes, that's what we are. That's exactly what we are. We're pirates. And it's up to you to kind of deal with that. So there's this sort of defiant quality. Now, I'd be willing to bet you that the skull and crossbones is a favorite among biker tattoos. So it's got that. There's something that's quite similar about the sentiment. I think it's an interesting comparison and a useful one.
Have you said that
they knew
tactics, but
they didn't
surrender?
I'm sorry,
I'm sorry. You were saying that pirates tactics, but they all surrendered when they saw the flag.
Yeah.
Surely that's the way all that was going to fall in history, because if you didn't surrender, you're simply put siege to every bit of dock. And maybe they were just looking at the ships and cities. And if you didn't surrender, you all die.
Well, I think there's a lot of truth to that. Although, in the 18th century, there are a lot of naval engagements, and actually Nicholas is writing about these, in which these two men of war come side by side, and what you hear are this incredible volley of broadsides, and then you hear moaning and cheering. Fair enough. But I think, you know, again, the Hollywood myth has us believing that pirates were constantly boarding ships and wanting to fight. They don't want to fight. They just wanted your booty. And they wanted you to surrender it without a fight. And that's what they did. Most people did.
That's true.
one behind the silver.
Can you just say something about how the golden age of piracy came to an end? Was it because the pirates were finally defeated by the state?
Good point. It does come to an end in the late 1720s. It comes to an end, I think, for a variety of reasons, but one of the things that happens is that the authorities destroy the bases on which pirates depended. In other words, pirates could roam here and there, but they always needed to have a place to come back to. And in 1721, there was a crucial piece of legislation passed in which the British government promised to execute anyone who cooperated with pirates. It's kind of the opposite of what Nicholas said about the landlord smugglers who could sort of push everything onto their servants. The British government was saying, we know that it's small merchants, usually in the colonies, who were buying pirated goods, and if we catch you, we're going to kill you too. This actually had a deterrent effect on merchants who increasingly didn't want to have anything to do with them, partly because there were other economic opportunities available to them. So essentially what I've suggested is that although piracy itself disappears as an international thing, it'll continue to be a coastal thing, it's still around today, although not in anything approaching the old magnitude. The tensions that produce piracy are basically suppressed and go back down below decks. And one of the things I found is that in the aftermath of the suppression of piracy, the number of murders on merchant ships goes up. Of captains murdering sailors and sailors murdering captains. So in a way, they managed to break the collective form of resistance, and the struggle or the kind of violence then is individualized. But it's still all there. Eventually, wages will go up in the 1730s, and some of the conditions will improve for sailors. But what I think may be most important is that even though the ruling classes of the day won the battle, and by that I mean they executed hundreds of pirates, and they basically created a world safe for commerce, they lost the war because we remember the pirates and we love them and we don't remember the rulers. So the pirates kind of have won in terms of our affections, I think.
I wanted to know, what was the relations of the pirates to the communities, for example, in Madagascar? What was the relation with the people there?
The question, in case people couldn't hear it, is what were the relationships between pirates and various communities? These were highly various. In some cases, they were extremely sympathetic relationships. There were places in Cuba, some places in Madagascar, some places in Belize where pirates could go and would be fed, they would trade, they would take, for example, mosquito Indians on board their vessels, frequently as fishermen. When the authorities attacked piracy, they also attacked these bases and essentially tried to criminalize the contact that those local people would have with the pirates. Another part of eliminating their base. In areas where pirates, well, I guess more in the Indian Ocean, some of the pirates that were active there were predatory. And some of them were involved in the slave trade, and so their relations with groups could be extremely conflictful and violent. And there is actually quite a bit of evidence of that. It depends very much on when and where. But in most port cities, I think you would have found that the seafaring population was quite friendly and sympathetic to the pirates. And in fact, one of the things the authorities are up against as they try to demonize the pirates is what they call, well, that these people are folk heroes to the people in the port cities, which is what made them nervous about the big crowds coming out to watch the executions. Because they know those people actually favored the pirates over the rulers who were having them executed, and there were instances where people were actually saved from the gallows by mobs. But pirates didn't dare come into the bigger port cities because the probability of being captured was so great. So they were reduced to ever smaller ports, and even those began to disappear, which is part of their being eliminated.
Thank you.
And by the way, these people did not retire to beachfront condominiums to use their wealth, at least in this generation, because the government would track people down years and years later and still hang them. So determined were they to demonstrate that this kind of piracy would not be tolerated, they really led a kind of war of execution, a war of capital punishment against these former pirates. So the ones who got away probably changed their names, disappeared to the lower deck of this or that ship. And if you were an officer or a well-known pirate, there was really no way for you to survive. Now, this is in big contrast to someone like Henry Morgan, who led these assaults on the Spanish main and was rewarded by the planters of Jamaica by being made lieutenant governor, as long as he would now turn in his former mates and help to execute them. But that didn't happen in the next generation of pirates. They weren't making any deals with those people.
You said that the life of a sailor was short. Have you any statistics about that? How long did sailors last?
Yeah, it's a very good question, and it's very hard to say. I don't have good statistics on it, but I can tell you this much. The mean age for sailors in the 18th century is in the 20s. And I can't really put a finer point on it than that, but I would say the average career for a common sailor would last 5, 6, 8, 10 years, whereupon one of two things would happen. Either they would find a different line of work and try to come ashore, and many did. They might work in the docks. They managed to save a little money. They might become a publican of some kind. Or they would simply die and be thrown over the side of the ship, wrapped up in a canvas sail. And there's plenty of that. In fact, one of the documents that I found recorded the throwing overboard of a man named Alexander Selkirk, who was the sailor who was the model for Robinson Crusoe. Died an ignominious death, I think it was on the west coast of Africa, a few years after he had been rescued from the island on which he had lived alone for several years. And that story had gotten to Daniel Defoe. It was just a very dangerous line of work because of disease, especially if you sail the coast of West Africa. Malaria, yellow fever, you're coming into all kinds of new disease environments. And, of course, the problems of accident were very great. Not only shipwreck, but falling gear. Sailors were killed quite frequently. And especially they were killed in the slave trade. That actually is one line of seafaring work for which we have evidence. And the evidence is really pretty gruesome. The mortality rate on slave ships was equal or even slightly higher than the mortality rate for the enslaved, between 15 and 20% per voyage. That's pretty shocking. Now, that part of that has to do with the way in which West Africa was a particularly deadly place for a lot of Europeans. But that gives you an idea of how deadly it could be.
It's pretty interesting that we're talking about this kind of like society at sea, you know, with regards to race, and you're talking here an example of the gay pirates, I was kind of thinking of that and wondering whether there was a beautiful sort of harmony of relationships from sexual preference to
It's a good question and a fair question. I think there is a lot of evidence for it. And I think the evidence is of many different kinds, including evidence of hostile people like ship captains who were on board, who are kind of amazed that common sailors can do anything without a proper officer on board. Right? Now, they complain that it's anarchic and disorderly, but it's just a different kind of order. Now, it's not to say that pirate ships were without conflict. They did things democratically, but they had conflict. but they worked the conflict out differently, not just by the use of the lash. So I think it is fair to say that the democratic, egalitarian, and multiracial social order of a pirate ship was one of the most progressive societies of its day. And I think the authorities were conscious of this and didn't like it.
There are still today examples of sea pirates, particularly in Southeast Asia and on the coast of Somalia. Do we have any understanding at all about how they operate? They don't have the same values as you talk about.
Yeah, good question. Questions about contemporary pirates, especially in the South China Seas. There are basically two types of pirates these days. The most spectacular of them are essentially high-tech, mafia syndicate-type operations in which pirates with high-speed boats and elaborate communication systems will take an oil tanker, kill the crew, bring the tanker into a port in China where they've already paid off the officials, pump out the oil, essentially put the ship in a chop shop for ships, and then send it back out under false papers. There have been some pretty spectacular cases like this over the past 10 years or so. This is probably 1% of all piracies. 99% of all piracies are much more like what I've described here. It's basically poor people coming up alongside a freighter, throwing a grappling hook up in the middle of the night, climbing up and taking some tools or some paint or something lying around on the deck, then going back down the rope onto their fishing vessels and taking off. Now, it's not the kind of thing that we find in the earlier period, because there's no sense of kind of a fraternity, of a collective involved in piracy. But it is similar in this respect. From time immemorial, whenever wealthy cargo ships pass through areas where there are poor people with seafaring means of their own, those poor people are going to try to get some of it if they can. And that's what they're still doing. But the fact is that this is very small-time stuff, and this is one reason why even the international shipping community is not especially upset about piracy at this point in time. It's a very small portion of international commerce that's affected, and the number of those kind of big dramatic takings of big ships is very small. But there are lots of poor pirates.
Show me again.
Sorry about this. I've got a mate who's a marine engineer. He's off in the South Seas now. So a couple of years ago, he was based in Vigo, northwest Spain, Galicia. There's a good restaurant, I'll tell you that. So he come across a case there. It was the Freedom of the Spanish. And they were pinching stuff that had fallen down from the American lot, NASA. And the pirates up around there, because they've got a site issue, they do the drugs in from the big ports down in South America. And they do it. It's one of those things, you know?
Sure.
It saves them
sure.
on the rates. But they were picking up stuff that had fallen out of the sky, as it does very often, capturing that, and then selling it back.
Yeah.
This is a form of piracy.
It is, or smuggling.
Yeah.
It's a kind of smuggling. I mean, I think there are lots of people in the Caribbean.
I'm very easy with this exercise. And they made lots of money.
Yes.
Lots.
Yeah.
And it's common knowledge in the seafaring community.
Sure.
But we're not close enough to know that all the time, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think in the Caribbean, this kind of thing and this sort of second economy and the illicit movement of this and that. I think this is still a very serious reality there, and one in which lots of lives are being made outside the wage economy.
Just a brief Marcus needs some rest. I just was wondering whether, you know, this egalitarianism of the pirates, how much was a response, of course, to the injustice and the need for solidarity in responding to the injustice, and also how much it was also rooted in pre-existing, you know, the social soil they were coming from.
Yeah. You know? The question is about the sources of the egalitarianism. I think it's actually both, and I think the two are related. I think that seafaring, as a very dangerous kind of work, creates solidarity, maybe only rivaled by mining. Seafaring and mining. And seafaring will change when the nature of the ship changes. But I think there's a tremendous amount of solidarity that just grows out of the work. So I think that's part of it. I think the difficulties that people had on board the ships, meaning just the basic pressure they were under, the kind of violence, this created an ethic of resistance and a belief that a certain kind of attitude to authority was necessary to your survival. Now, I know that, I don't know about Bristol, but I know that there are a lot of people in Liverpool who think that this attitude is the essence of Liverpool culture. And that it's essentially seafaring, that it's collectivist, it's egalitarian, it's anti-authoritarian, it's given to the flamboyant gesture. So I think there is a way in which what we see in piracy is just one perhaps very clear reflection of a social reality that's fairly common at sea, both long before and long after. It's just that when they became pirates, they had the ability to organize their ships as they really wanted to do. And I think that expressed some of those values that come from other places. And in those other places, the kind of working solidarity and the sense of injustice were all bound up together. I think that may be the key to it.
Right. We're on a ship together, though, to captain. What about you? Any more then? Well, it must be time to crack the rum open, so I'd just like to say thank you for Marcus coming up.
Thank you.